Welcome to episode 2 of The Glider Show. I'm Sam, your host, and this is a podcast about learning to fly gliders. You're invited to come with me on my journey from ham-fisted rookie to hopefully graceful future solo pilot soaring over the fields and hills of Dartmoor. Now, the older you get, the harder it is to retain complex information. So, this could be a long journey. But stick with me and hopefully we'll find out some interesting stuff along the way and meet some weird and wonderful characters in the gliding clubs and the gliding community online. I'm about 2 months into my journey to become a solo glider pilot, and it's been a bit frustrating recently because we've had a remarkably wet summer and the airfield is waterlogged. Worse yet, there's probably very little chance of it drying out over the winter because it's just going to get wetter and wetter. On those weekends where it's raining, there's not much flying. And even where it isn't raining and there is flying, it's starting to churn the ground up pretty badly. So it's a kind of balance now between letting the airfield recover and letting some of the water drain away and trying to get some time in the air. So a little bit frustrating, and I've been finding myself choosing Sundays as the day to try and go and fly. And the last few Sundays, I've been firmly stuck on the ground, confined to the clubhouse. In our on-the-ground section this week, we're going to hear a bit about the classroom learning that I've been experiencing in these last couple of weeks. In the air, this show will see me taking to the simulator to try out spins, rolls and recoveries. And we'll also be making sense of the primary and secondary effects of the main control surfaces like ailerons and rudder. So on the last couple of Sundays that I've turned up at the club, I've been treated to some very intensive one-to-one tuition, and I've been very lucky to have the attention of our chief flying instructor, Don. Now, the first weekend, I happened to be trying out the flight simulator while some of the more experienced pilots were preparing for exams, and they got into some fairly technical discussions. So by eavesdropping on their conversations, I was able to learn quite a bit about the environmental lapse rate, the adiabatic lapse rate, saturated adiabatic lapse rate, these technical terms, but it essentially helped me to understand how patches of air heat up and then break away from the ground to form thermals, and how they progress upwards through the atmosphere and the rate at which they cool in relation to their surroundings. Now, I also learned on that day how hail forms, a great question, which I hadn't really thought about before until Don put the question to the group. Hail is formed by water freezing around a particle of dust, but most importantly, cycling back up and through freezing or near-freezing clouds. So there's a washing machine process which spins the hail round in a big cycle, and each time it goes round, it adds more ice to the hailstone. It's a Sunday, and it's supposed to be raining today. The weather forecast was wrong, but there's no real surprise there, is there? So I'm going up to the field, and it's about 11:30, so I expected it to rain, so I've missed the start of play, but I'm going to go up there and see if I can do anything new and useful, maybe help out. So last couple of days, I've launched the Glider Show podcast out on Audioboo, put it out, two episodes, first two, out yesterday. I'm sitting in the car recording this just before I leave, and I'm starting to boil because I'm wearing my new Marks & Spencer's thermals bought specially for the glider field. So I'm going to test out today what difference standing around all day in a pair of Marks & Spencer's thermals makes. And I think, judging by how I'm feeling right now, it probably will make a difference. I'll let you know how those get on. So for now, let's get the car started. Let's get underway. And let's see what's happening up at the field. Of course, what I forget is that the gliding field is actually probably about 200 or 300 feet higher up than my house. So what starts out looking like a nice high cloud base, lovely day for gliding, looks a little bit different by the time I've driven straight up the road for a couple of miles towards the top of the hill, which is where the Dartmoor Gliding Society field is situated. So it's suddenly, by the time we're up here, there's not quite as much room to play as there was as it seemed there was when I started out from home. So I'm just turning onto the road here, rolling down towards the club, and let's have a look and see if we can see anyone up in the air. I'll just freewheel it as we go down here. So it's got some patches of blue up there, and we've got some dirty grey clouds going across. And I think it looks to me like it's coming from a south, coming from the south, I think. I'm not very sure about that, but I can't see anyone in the air at the moment. I'm just having a quick scan around. And it may be, if there's nobody up, you never know, it may, first of all, have been cancelled. But I would suspect we might be getting to a time where the ground is so boggy that it's in danger of becoming unusable. And that would be a real shame, but judging by the last couple of weeks and then judging by the amount of rain last night, it wouldn't surprise me if that's the case. If so, I'm sure there'll be plenty of stuff going on in the clubhouse to get involved in, whether it's learning flight theory or whether it's fixing broken things. But we'll dive in and we'll have a look. I'm going to park up here next to this van, but these conditions are boggy, unbelievably boggy, as we slide about trying to get out. Hear the ground underfoot. Completely soaked. Oh, it's soaking.
Situation that you're confronted is on the approach, you're going to hit that. You're on a collision course for it. So that's basically the principles of a normal approach. What the pilot's doing is he's controlling the speed with his right hand. He's controlling the rate of descent with his left. He's going to make as few adjustments as possible. So if he appears to be overshooting, like the reference here is going down in his field of view, he'll apply more air brake. Temptation might be to put the nose down. Yeah, but then you're just going to go faster, which isn't necessarily going to help. Okay. So here's something that's wrong. You tell me what's wrong. And what's right?
Speed's going down.
But the reference area is the same distance as the camera. So now what this is.
What's going to happen is you're going to stall it.
Ultimately, yeah. So he's undershooting, but he's keeping the picture right by coming back on the step.
So the only way you're going to get out of that is to pull the nose up, which is going to stall you anyway.
Yeah, the only solution to that is close the brakes. So it's a bit like tapping your head and rubbing your tummy. The solution to that problem is close the brakes, maintain the speed with the stick and the rate of descent. So undershooting, less brake please, overshooting, more brake please. Here's another example of getting it wrong. Now this time he's maintaining the position because he's just flying at it. The solution to this would be to increase the air brakes. If you are at full air brake and it's still happening, I'm sorry, you're going to overshoot. Live with it. You're going to end up further up the field. Here's undershooting. So this time speed's right, but we are undershooting. We should be putting the brake away. If we can't, then I'm sorry. No, the answer is not to slow down. In fact, in this scenario, if you've done everything you can and that's still happening, the real answer is to dive.
If you're undershooting?
Yeah, dive, don't try to raise the nose. If you dive, a couple of things. One, you will cut down through the wind gradient and you'll be in weaker, lower air. So you'll glide before.
Isn't that counterintuitive? Because what you're going to do is lower the air brakes and that means your nose will
Well, if you shut the air brakes now, yeah, does the nose go up in relation to the tank?
If you shut the air brakes, say the air brakes were shut and you're undershooting like that,
yeah,
if you were to actually increase speed,
yeah,
well, I know it's counterintuitive, but you actually do increase speed, get down to within half a wingspan of the ground,
yeah,
and then follow the ground, your glide performance would go up from 25:1 to 500:1.
Yeah.
Because you're going to use ground effect.
Yeah.
You will have less, you'll be in the lower wind, so you'll have effectively a greater glide performance because you're lower down in the wing gradient. So, approach control, so top tips. If you want to do an accurate approach, longer approaches are much better. It gives you time to get settled down, gives you time to make adjustments. If you do a split arse turn and a short approach, and sometimes you see us doing it when we're perhaps doing a rapid turnaround thing, they're a bit demanding. Mm-hmm. So when you're starting off, nice, settled approach. No, it's a jumbo jet. Because, air brakes change your rate of descent. The attitude via the stick gives you your airspeed.
Yeah.
Now, you will find that inevitably you are going to screw that up. Mm-hmm. If you don't, you'll be the first pupil who doesn't. But if you just remember that, so as you're practicing, make few adjustments to the air brakes and consider them before you do them. That's it. Cool.
I think at the end of that, Don, the chief flying instructor, was starting to plan for a regular Sunday crew, a kind of Sunday school. And I think it's a really good idea because one of the challenges, I think, is that many members, possibly newcomers like me, wake up in the morning, check the weather and think, there's not going to be any flying today, so we don't bother turning up. But I think the club is finding it hard to get people there early enough and to stay all day. And I think as soon as they see the weather's not great, they either come later in the day, which is what I'm guilty of, or they don't turn up at all. But I really like the idea of a regular Sunday school, so that even if the weather's unflyable, a group of people can be learning roughly at the same time and sharing information. So I'm game for that. Now, because of the weather, my in-the-air time was really on the ground, but I've been finding out how good the club simulator really is. Now, it runs on Condor, which, as I've mentioned before, is pretty much the accepted standard gliding simulation software. It's quite old, but it's reckoned by all to be the best there is, and having had now a couple of times trying it out, I'm inclined to go along with that. And coupled with a full-size twin-seater cockpit from a K-13, featuring working joystick and rudder pedals, with a big screen in front of you, it's pretty realistic, and it's a great way to learn. So I had the privilege of having Chief Flying Instructor Don get in the backseat and put me through my paces, showing me how to stall the K-13 in the simulator and to take me through the recovery procedure.
Notice that what happens, I tried to bully it around the turn with the rudder. So I got it going slowly, trying to stretch the glide.
So you kept it full rudder, right, to keep
and
it in the spin?
To get it to turn faster, I pushed the rudder, because that's what I wanted it to do.
Right. So once you're in the spin, you've left it over full rudder.
No, and I'm trying to hold the nose up, and I'm just stick it right back.
Yeah, so now we're in a spin.
Okay, so now you recover, you have control.
So push it rudder, nose down, pick up some speed.
No.
It's
a spiral dive, you see the speed building up. So therefore, spiral dive, roll the wings level, ease out and dive, which is a different recovery. So try raising the nose again. Now just visualise this, you're trying to get home. You're trying to stretch, you're doing it wrong, but you're trying to stretch the glider. You're trying to make the glider go as far as possible. And in error, you're holding the nose, it makes it look better. You've got one more turn to do, but you don't want to bank very steeply because the wind could hit the trees. Right? That's how low you are. So in order to get it to go round, push the rudder. So to encourage it.
No, it's still very high.
You can see, just looking at the ASI, stick to roll the wings level, you'll push your stick forward. That's a spiral dive. The difference from a spiral dive and spin, particularly on simulated, is what's the ASI doing? If it spins, if it's spinning, the ASI will be basically a lower and fluctuating airspeed. If it's a spiral dive, the speed will be just progressively increasing. So we'll put it back in the, we'll try it off a flat one, flat turn. A little bit of bank here. Speed's coming down. Trying to hold this nose up, pushing it round. Now you can see the ASI now.
So it's dropped right off.
Yeah. Okay, you have control.
So this one is to...
Full opposite rudder.
Full opposite rudder.
Essentially pull the stick until the spin stops. The spin will stop. Central on the rudder. If you take too long, you can get too far.
Yeah.
So a good recovery would probably have the SB indicator in the green arc.
Right.
That one, I mean, it's okay. And they will get faster, depending. But it'd be better if you stay inside the green arc.
So I didn't snap the wings off, but I was uncomfortably close.
Yeah, well, you're beyond VA, but beneath VNE.
So
it wasn't in any... I'm not unhappy with it. But it illustrates when we recover from the recovery, once we've recovered, the aircraft will now pick up speed quite quickly.
Yeah.
And we need to...
Now, by the end of the simulated flight, I was recovering nicely from stalls and spiral dives. And one of the things that I experienced as I pulled the nose of the glider gently up to bleed off speed, instead of controlling it by using the ailerons, Don encouraged me to use the rudder pedals to just keep the wings level. And I got to explore a very interesting piece of information. And that is that each of these primary control surfaces has a primary and a secondary effect. So holding the glider's nose steady and the wings level by using the rudder was an example of using the rudder's secondary effect instead of its primary effect. And I was reminded of stories of airliners whose pilots had lost all control of the main control surfaces and yet had managed to fly the aircraft back to, in some cases, land, and other cases, crash land near or on the runway. How, if all your flight surfaces are non-functioning, can you control an aircraft? How can you make it change its elevation? How can you make it bank and turn? How can you make it yaw when you need to? If you're old enough, you may remember a famous crash back in the 1980s of a passenger plane at Sioux City in the US. This is a plane where a tail strike had severed all three of the independent hydraulic systems that controlled all the different primary control surfaces. And at a certain point in the flight, the pilots realized they had absolutely no control. A test pilot, who was a passenger at the time, came forward to assist the pilots, and using only the throttle controls and applying different levels of power to each engine, managed to, first of all, save the plane from going into a fatal spiral dive or actually inverting, and then by careful control of both engines, managed to effect a series of turns to bring the aircraft back towards the Sioux City Airport. In the end, that plane suffered an unexpected banking maneuver just before landing, which took it away from the runway, and it crash-landed just off the runway. And I think there were something like 185 people were killed, but miraculously 111 survived. That always struck me as incredible. How did they manage to control it, and how could you use the engines? And of course, it's an example of the pilot's ingenuity in using the various secondary effects of the control surfaces. So by putting extra power into the right-hand engine, it caused the left wingtip to move slower in relation to the right wingtip. That yawing motion then produced a secondary effect of rolling the aircraft, allowing the pilots to effect a kind of turn. So amazingly, they got back, and amazingly, some people survived that crash. Now, there is actually an instance of a jet airliner actually surviving the loss of all controls and making a safe landing. And that happened, I think, in 2003 with a DHL cargo plane taking off from Baghdad Airport, which was struck by a ground-to-air missile. And using the engine differential, again, the three-man crew managed to bring the aircraft back. And unlike the Sioux City crash, this crew lowered the wheels early enough to bleed off some of the excess speed that they couldn't otherwise control and made a successful landing. Admittedly, it went off the runway and tore up a field and pulled down some fences, but the three crew survived and the aircraft was largely intact. Another thing that came up in Don's teaching over the last couple of weekends was the idea of forward slipping or side slipping in a glider. This is one of those concepts that you'll hear when you're learning a new skill like flying a glider that I really recommend that you take a note of it and go and research as soon as you hear it. Don't let it pass you by without taking a moment or two to go and do some research to find out. Once upon a time when I used to ride powerful motorcycles, I'd read in the motorcycle press about a thing called a tank slapper. And it's one of those expressions that I had read so many times. I came to believe I knew what it meant, but actually had no real idea whatsoever. I thought it referred to hitting something so hard that you crushed your nuts on the fuel tank of the bike. Until one day, years later, I was doing about 90 miles an hour, two up, somewhere in deepest rural Ireland, and my bike hit some little indentation in the road, and the handlebars were wrenched out of my grip, with the front wheel slamming from side to side for about 50 yards down the road, until suddenly my hands came back on the grip and the bike went straight forward. And that, I discovered, was a tank slapper, and it can be fatal. Now, side slip and forward slip is one of those concepts that you will learn as a trainee pilot anyway, because your instructor will train you how to do it. But I wanted to find out quicker, so I went to YouTube, and pretty soon I realized that a forward slip or a side slip is a way of inclining the aircraft to lose height quickly. It's a way of turning it slightly side on. Imagine a plane on a video, you've seen them coming in a strong crosswind, and they use the rudder to crab their way in against the wind. It looks like the plane's almost flying 45 degrees sideways to the alignment of the runway. And now if you do that deliberately, i.e. there's no crosswind, but you turn the aircraft into that sort of diagonal flying position, what happens is you change the whole profile of the aircraft to the air you're flying through, and it increases massively the amount of drag and therefore increases the glide slope. It's a technique used to lose height very quickly. It's also a technique if the air brakes fail and you can't use them for some reason to increase your glide slope to get in for a safe landing. So it was brilliant to find that out. As I say, recommend don't take anything for granted. Go to Google and find out. Even if you just read a couple of lines on Wikipedia, give yourself that head start. It's really worth it. Well, that's all for episode 2 of The Glider Show, and I thank you for taking the time to listen, and I hope that you found it useful. I've only just started this podcast, so there is plenty of room for improvement as we go through, and that's where you come in. If you're a newcomer or more experienced glider pilot and you want to comment on anything you've heard or take part in the show in any way, please do get in touch. You can check the details in the take. I was going to say take that. You can check the take part page on the website at ukglider.com for various ways to get involved. I look forward to hearing from you. I'm Sam Deeks. This was The Glider Show. And until next time, safe flying.